This is Transported. I've recently returned from my first stint in Israel since October the 7th, and it has left me with much to ponder. In this episode, I'm going to give some analysis of the hostage situation. I'm going to say some things that may be quite difficult and problematic for people to hear, so there's a little trigger warning there. And now I'll jump right in. So the first thing that I noticed on coming back to Israel was this almost schizophrenic feeling on the streets. I would say a cognitive dissonance, perhaps, where people are trying to move on from the events of October the 7th and trying to live a normal life despite the ongoing war around them, and at the same time being completely unable to move past the fact of the horrors of that day and the trauma that the nation has undergone every day since, both because we are prosecuting a war, the consequences that that has on us, and the consequences that most Israelis also are well aware of for the ordinary Palestinians, many of whom had nothing to do with and may not be supportive of Hamas's operation before and after October the 7th. And of course, we cannot forget the hostages. The hostages are front and center in Israeli public life. There are memorials and signs and reminders on different street corners. There are works of art. And in Tel Aviv itself, of course, we have Kikar Hatufim, Hostage Square. One of the first things I noticed when I went to visit Hostage Square was that everything is in Hebrew. It's not supposed to be some kind of visiting spot so that we can show the West or show journalists about the hostages. It's for us, it's for Israelis. It's for us to have the reminder that life will never be normal again, even after we get whichever hostages back that Hamas haven't already murdered. The fact of those hostages being held and being taken in that way and being used as pawns in a sickening psychological game is something that has struck a real blow to the heart of Israeli society. And as much as we will do our best to defend ourselves against the physicality of it happening again, and as much as we will probably deal fairly well with the psychological trauma of what has happened, there will be scar tissue there. Kikar Hatufim is the place that we go to try and internalize those feelings of what has happened and the consequences going forward. One of the oddities of standing on that square is that you can hear people chatting away at the coffee shop right next to it. You can hear the sound of construction. Cranes are whirling overhead, building Israel as we take steps forward, even as we are stuck in a quite horrific present and immediate past. So we live in these two parallel lives. And I think one of the problems is that it's very difficult to see a way to meld those into one life where we really deal with these two realities at the same time. It's easier to separate them, and that results in that feeling of almost a schizophrenic existence. People are partying just that extra bit hard in Tel Aviv. The bars are full, the restaurants are full. It's extraordinary. And I think that partly, yes, it's defiance, and partly it is just trying to forget, trying to move on for at least those hours of the day that we can. One of the reasons, I think, for that almost defensiveness in the attitude towards the ongoing war and hostage situation is that there is something that I think we all know in our souls. The two stated winning goals of this war are the dismantling of Hamas as a meaningful structure of government and terrorism, and the return of our hostages. And I think we all know that those two goals are quite likely to be mutually exclusive. We may end up in a position where we return our hostages or we remove Hamas. The Israeli government has not caved into having negotiations with Hamas without having any idea what they're negotiating for, because Hamas refuses to say how many hostages are alive. Now, there are a couple of reasons why Hamas might choose to do that. One is they don't know, because many of those hostages are still held by other organizations and private citizens. A second is that most or all of them are dead or will be, because the likelihood of Hamas releasing women who've been gang raped for 5 months seems fairly slim to me. And of course, it could just be the usual psychological warfare that Hamas like to carry out on us. In any event, it seemed to me to be a perfectly reasonable prerequisite for negotiation, and I don't really give a stuff what Kamala Harris or anyone else has to say about that, or their efforts to try and pressure us into conceding things to them when the basic concession of telling us who is alive cannot even be given to us. Of course, Hamas are well aware that by making sure that the two goals of victory remain mutually exclusive, they are beginning to drive a wedge in Israeli society between those who prioritize one over the other. And we can't let that happen. In the words of Thomas Sowell, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. We have to recognize that the other side of that debate is just as much us, whichever side we instinctively fall on. This subject cannot be allowed to become a political football. We need to listen to the other side of that argument with the utmost respect and compassion. Because, unfortunately, whichever side of that debate turns out to be the so-called winning side, it will also be a loss for all of us on some very profound level. It certainly shouldn't be a left versus right issue, but there is an extent to which it speaks to divides in Israeli society that predate October the 7th, and as previously discussed, may even be somewhat causal to it. We have a fundamental debate here about values such as empathy versus stoicism, justice versus mercy. But I think we all must learn from past mistakes when it came to hostage trade. And of course, the Gilad Shalit experience is the one that comes foremost to mind, of giving over 1,000 people for him, and then some of those very same people being the architects and operators of October the 7th. That simply cannot be allowed to happen again. We cannot all become effective hostages. In many ways, and I have said this since the very beginning, I think it is incumbent on us to have the mentality of girding ourselves for this to be Munich, instead of us imagining that it will be Entebbe. Let us pray for it to be Entebbe, but let us prepare ourselves for it to be Munich. And that's also a really difficult thing to internalize. The families and friends of these hostages walk among us. I had Shabbat dinner a couple of weeks ago with the parents of Noah Argamani in Athens. And God forbid that I should have to say any of this to them and see their reactions. But it seems to me that they are also girding themselves very much for that reality. And well, they might. We even saw what that looked like in the face and the words of Thomas Hand, the father of Emily Hand, the Israeli-Irish girl who was thought to have been killed, and her father was actively happy that that had happened rather than her suffering miserably and possibly still dying. And then, of course, he had to find a different type of happiness when it turned out that she was alive. And of course, finally, we all shared in his joy when she was released, and albeit psychologically, clearly harmed, at least physically in one piece. October the 7th was a really sharp reminder of where exactly we live and why we actually have nowhere else to go. And hence that we have to make it work here. We've been living in a wonderful bull run where there were the occasional terrorist attacks, but because they only killed, and I say only in inverted commas, one or two people here or there, it was this slow drip of Chinese water torture that somehow we found tolerable. And that suited the Bibi style of conflict management. And in fact, Bibi is not alone or special in this regard. One of the observations that I think we can make of the West's handling of the Ukraine war is that they've made sure that Ukraine doesn't lose, but God forbid they actually help Ukraine to win. And that shouldn't be a surprise, because the West has, in general, lost the ability to win wars. It's not something we do anymore. It's all about management, because resolution involves bloodshed and occupation and destruction. And these are all things that the average person on the street just can't face anymore. That's partly, you could argue, because we've all become very coddled, because we don't have national service anymore. There are many excuses. You could also argue that because of social media, the realities hit all of us in the face so much harder and quicker that it means that war is generally something that we're less bullish about. But I would also argue that it is because of an increasing lack of deep principle among our political leaders. There's nobody Churchillian enough to say, actually, we have to do this and we have to see it through. And even those people who sound Churchillian for 5 minutes clearly don't have an exactly profound track record of doing so for all the right reasons. I give you, for example, on that, Boris Johnson, who charged in to tell poor old Zelensky, yes, we've got your back, this is necessary, we must stand up to evil. I think subsequently we all saw Boris Johnson for the fraud and charlatan that he is, and it brings into discredit anything that he said on almost any subject. And so we return to this problem of how do we win? I've similarly said from the very beginning of all of this that we have a tendency to be alarmist. We said at the beginning, oh, this is the new Yom Kippur War, it's the 50th anniversary since 1973, and I saw this very quickly as being actually more like 1967. There was an opportunity to turn the tables, switch the narrative, and put ourselves on the front foot. We still have that opportunity even 5 months later, and we have to seize it. One of the single biggest, and in my view, accurate criticisms of Bibi, which is leading to Western countries beginning to be highly critical of what's going on, has been that there has been no clearly publicly stated plan for the day after. Not a plan for the Palestinian day after, not a plan for the Israeli day after, and not a plan for the Israeli international and Israeli diaspora day after. Those are all individual planks of a wider strategy that must be declared. Does such a strategy exist? It's hard to tell. I can definitely try and unpack my own ideas around all of those. But the point of this episode was really to try and get all of us thinking more clearly and honestly about the problems that we face in the current phase of the war, and about the way in which we might try and emerge from this war stronger and more united than ever. I hope it's Entebbe. I hope it's 1967. I hope that Bibi will turn out to surprise us and be a Begin or a Ben-Gurion. And I hope that everybody listening to this will feel, whether they're in Israel or the diaspora, the same surge of pride and resilience that we must have felt in the aftermath of 48 and 67. If there's one thing that we understand as Jews and Israelis, it's that we will always be othered. We'll always be, to some degree, outsiders, at the same time as which we strive to be accepted and normal and to be a part of the societies in which we find ourselves. That's a cognitive dissonance that we've learned to live with. We spent so long in the diaspora, and now we have a state. And I think that we haven't quite worked out how to take the thesis and antithesis of those two ways of being, and to find a synthesis where these are not two separate modes, but we find some unifying mode. Fitting in and being the other are just two different hats that we wear with the same person underneath. I think a lot of the time our enemies feed on our doubts that when we take off that hat, whichever one it is that we're wearing, we feel very naked and we don't like who we find under the hat. I think it's time that we took off the hats with more pride, stood tall and said, Hineni, I'm right here, I'm not going anywhere, whether that's you trying to hound me out of my historical homeland, or whether it's you trying to hound me out of the countries in which I have lived and contributed for generations. And we've earned our seat at the table of nations. As the apocryphal story of Begin pushing back on a comment by Biden goes, we are not Jews with trembling knees anymore. So if we really want Biachad Nenatzeach, then we have to leave the othering to others, and we need to stay genuinely together. And that means a return to the big tent of who is a Jew and who is a Zionist, and genuine mutual respect within that tent. I invite you all to be inside the tent pissing out. Sorry, Mum, but that's an actual expression. If you're listening to this on Spotify, you will find that there is a place to send some feedback to me. That would be a great place to do it. Otherwise, 99% of my listeners know how to find me. Please find me. I would love to hear from you. Biyachad Nenatzeach.